KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is, I think, does magic with the written word. And what she's done from her films, from Life Partners to her new film, The Spy Who Dumped Me, and her book, Nuclear Family, is, I think, how best to put this, takes a look at archetypes and examines what's under there. The idea of, for her, I think, thinking you judge a book by a cover and you find out you really can't is what she does as a writer. My guest, of course, is Susanna Fogle. First of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of the show. So.
Oh, you're the one. God, I've always wanted to meet you.
Me and all my friends.
Okay. Well, I'll meet them too.
Great.
We can give them all Jolly Ranchers. But I think one of the things that, for example, between Life Partners and The Spy Who Dumped Me is taking the idea of somebody who doesn't know what to do with her life and is judged by everybody for not knowing what to do with her life. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting character to start off with for a comedy, because that could also be a very dramatic situation too.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's that sort of struggle to make peace with yourself and the ways that your dreams have or haven't come true at that age of, I think, around the 30th birthday, that crisis of many. It's often a favorite part of other movies too. Like, my favorite part of Bridesmaids was sort of the slightly depressing, like, reckoning that Kristen Wiig had with herself. It wasn't the hijinks as much as it was the kind of finding the humor in the pain. So to me, that's always a great jumping off point. It could have definitely been the backbone of a very indie dramedy, if not for the explosions and car chases that accompany it in this particular movie.
Well, there are kind of figurative explosions in Life Partners. Mm-hmm. And funny, because I sort of think of what you do is kind of like not dissimilar to Nicole Hall Center, mm-hmm. who traffics in that same kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the
emotional trafficking.
Yes. That could be your next book. That's such a great title.
I love it.
But that idea of playing that for the comedy, mm-hmm. and also these figures in both the movies are people who, again, you can judge them as one thing and we quickly learn out that there's something else. Mm-hmm. But having your characters be so vivid from the very beginning, mm-hmm. is something I think about now with you.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. I've always been into just sort of observational humor and analyzing people, for better or worse. My mom is a psychologist and my dad is a psychiatrist. So when you grow up in that environment, you are always looking under the hood and looking for someone's deep neurosis and trauma, and using words like neurosis and trauma, which isn't what normal preteen girls are doing. But I think that is the lens through which I see everything. And so applying it to sort of a big, crazy movie like this was a lot of fun, but it still came from the same place of, what is this person's like essential insecurity and what are they trying to get, and how can you kind of make the ending for them bittersweet and still make it a Hollywood movie?
It's interesting because it gives something that's a genre piece an emotional center, but there's also a clock in this too. The idea of playing with all these tropes, but introducing characters who provisionally don't belong in something like this.
Yeah. I mean, I think trying to ground the characters emotionally and kind of bring that element into a genre that really doesn't get very emotional was of interest. I mean, gender aside, it's sort of, they usually do a nod to sort of the emotion of Jason Bourne or, you know, any Batman. You see these moments where there's sort of the flashback that shows why they're broken, but they've been broken by the time the movie starts. Why are you laughing at me? They do.
No, it's so funny because that's exactly what
it is. Yeah, like there's like a dreamy flashback on the beach with, you know, someone's dad that got killed or someone's wife that got killed in the line of fire, you know, whatever. And it's great. But once the movie really kicks off, you're not really revisiting their feelings. You're not really delving into James Bond's feelings. Not that you have to do that, but that's just an unexplored way of seeing a person who's risking death all the time in the quieter moments that you're skipping. You're really tabbing through those when you're in a bigger movie like that.
Well, I was laughing because I thought it was a great observation.
Oh, thank you.
I thought it was really funny.
No, I mean, you can laugh. You can laugh at me or with.
I'll choose to not laugh for a little bit and just try to ask questions.
Great.
Here. But what's fun about the movie is that you mentioned James Bond. It's structured almost like a Bond movie. There's an opening action sequence that's sort of not related to what happens directly after.
Yeah.
And talk about that structuring. In fact, this is the point you can tell the audience what the movie's about.
Oh.
Although the title gives us
a hint at that point, right. The title that was sort of always intended to be just a fun title that would get people to read the script in the first place. We're like, oh, you know, it's too Bond, it's too this, it's too that. And then by the time we were, you know, revisiting it, we were all, it was so much part of the DNA of the film. And also we couldn't think of another title that better and more efficiently told you exactly what the movie is about. But anyway, yeah, I mean, I think I love those big opening sequences. I love throwing you right into the action. So this movie starts with what was, in our mind, the sort of prototypical action sequence, which is sort of a Bourne-esque. It's sort of shot and styled like that action sequence that's very muscular and stars a man. And in that down-the-middle action movie, this would be his movie. But it's quickly kind of like mashed up with what would be the start of a Bridget Jones-style movie, which is two girls dealing with their birthday and their, like, feelings about turning 30 and, you know. So by clicking back and forth between the two for the first 10 minutes of the movie, we want to sort of say to the audience, you're gonna see these two stories ultimately clash, but each one's kind of trying to service its genre in the most faithful way that it can, rather than try to put humor into the Justin Theroux stuff and action into, you know, this birthday party. Like, let them be what they want to be and then weave them together once you've kind of established them.
What the action has here is an emotional impact because it becomes almost Hitchcockian in that there are real people who are thrust into these things, surrounded by people who know what they're doing.
Right.
But at no point do the tables get turned and suddenly the real people or become too efficient or the spies become slapsticky.
Well, it's interesting because it feels like with this new kind of push to sort of put women in these leading roles, there's this sort of new type of action hero that's female. It's kind of just a pronoun flipped version of the male action heroes we've seen, where it's great to have those narratives, but it doesn't tell the whole story. And it's not that everything has to be gendered, but in showing these women that are they're not perfect specimens of an action hero. Nor are they completely fumbling through. They're sort of having their own mini arc, but that arc, it's a micro change. They're not in the course of 97 minutes becoming masterful spies, because then, you know, how could we possibly convince Lionsgate to give us a sequel? We couldn't. Be over.
It's the treatment. We're pitching a sequel to The Spy Who Dumped Me with my guest. It's writer, director, Susanna Fogel. I guess what I'm saying all these things about is that it's clear that you've given a lot of thought to kind of superstructure in terms of, if we look at the differences between Light Partners and this, there was a need the characters had to over-explain themselves, which feels like classic screwball comedy to me. An American thing where people are constantly trying to say who and what they are, even though it's clear that Gillian Jacobs had no idea who or what she was.
Right, yeah.
But she was constantly trying to say that anyway.
Yeah.
And Leighton was kind of trying to explain what she wasn't.
Right.
But this over-articulation.
Yeah.
And finding the physical correlative to that is kind of a quantum leap in filmmaking terms, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you bring that up, just the idea of characters who consider themselves self-aware but in fact completely lack self-awareness. I think that it's sort of like the backbone of great comedy is a person who they're incredibly committed to whatever their truth is. They don't find anything funny about how you know, determined they are to be who they are. And so what's so funny about it is what they don't even realize they're doing. And so I think that that's what leads to the most specific voices for characters to have. It's like, this person is a total know-it-all and everything they say, you know, is said with this arrogance. But what's funny is that they're making all these mistakes in what they're saying. That's like a funny character's voice. And it, I think just trying to find that kind of comedic game or angle to each kind of major player in your movie, whether your movie's a micro-budget indie movie or a big spy movie that has comedy, it leads to things feeling character-driven when in fact they're just, I think they're just specific more than anything else.
Well, it feels like a difficult thing to do because you have to insert character into plot momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two very different disciplines and two yeah. very different skill sets. But there's so many things going on here. That's why I was talking about superstructure, because finally, it's sort of about this thing that's the constant dynamic in your work, it feels like, which is the distance between professionalism mm-hmm. and not having a career to attach yourself to.
Yeah.
And the kind of crush that Kate McKinnon's character has on Gillian Anderson's character.
Yeah.
Because she's doing this thing.
I mean, yeah.
There's almost this kind of odd admiration for the fact that these spies at least know what they're doing mm-hmm. and know who they are.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, it was sort of like in the comedic world of like turning a comedic lens on the sort of powerful, confident, well-dressed, well-spoken woman that the Joan Allen, Judi Dench, like the women that are in these movies that are like, oh my God, how do you ever get to be that? What were you like when you were 30 and had a roommate? Like, were you ever that? Or were you just born wearing this like incredibly tailored suit? You know, Kate, the funniest dynamic that we could think of was that person, our version of that person, really playing it straight from one of those franchises, kind of engaging with the unpredictable wildness and like lack of decorum of Kate's character, and the sort of, the more impolitic Kate is, the funnier it is to watch, you know, basically have this impact on someone who seems completely impenetrable, usually. So to us, that was really funny. It's like the funniest thing you can do is throw Gillian Anderson in a room with someone who is like, oh my God, you're amazing. What are you wearing? What's the deal? And Gillian is like completely not in that version of a female conversation. She's just doing her own thing, floating above humanity. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of like mashing up the completely human, relatable, like lower statusness of these girls with the sort of embodiment of these tropes, I guess, that do make these action movies work really well.
I'm having a great time, but we have to take a break.
Okay.
My guest is the writer-director of the great new film I had a really good time at, The Spy Who Dumped Me, Susanna Fogel, with The Treatment. We're going to take a break. There's more to come.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Seen on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Seen on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. Having a good time with my guest, Susanna Fogel, whose new film as writer-director is The Spy Who Dumped Me. We should talk about the characters that Mila and Kate play. Mila is the kind of the almost classic Hitchcockian protagonist who's thrown into a world they don't understand. I mean, this could be any number of Hitchcock films starring Jimmy Stewart,
mm-hmm.
who is forced to sort of take on this whole new persona to some extent, but really can't after she finds out that her ex-boyfriend was a super spy, and Kate McKinnon, with whom you've worked so well in the past, okay. is all id, but completely enthralled to whatever's happening at any particular moment. I mean, it's kind of funny. She throws an actor's concentration into anything she's doing at any particular moment, which I thought was such a great way to get about, to get at the narcissism of acting. Whatever she's doing at that particular moment is the most important thing in the world.
Right. Which is, it's sort of the stakes that she applies to, you know, her auditions and the stakes she's applying to an actual life and death situation are like equal level of intensity for her. I mean, we love the idea of a person who is completely fearless in the case of Kate's character. And, you know, we didn't want to just have the story be these are two women who have no confidence, or, you know, we didn't want either of them to have that trajectory of she has no confidence and then she is kicking ass by the end. Just because I feel like, sure, there are women for whom that's the resonant story. But in my opinion, and at least in my taste as like a storyteller, it's more interesting to sort of operate from like the indie school of character development, which is like, okay, she's got strengths and weaknesses and we're going to see both of them. Like Mila Kunis is never going to play too low status in a role because she is a confident person and she kind of exudes like a self-assuredness as an actor. And to me, that made her an interesting and like exciting choice to play someone who's going through a situation that in another actor's hands would make them just seem like completely insecure and broken. So it just kind of created a more nuanced version of a person that felt bad about themselves.
But it's also the aspect that makes it real and not a sketch character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that too.
Because that's what a sketch character is. Somebody who's constantly upstaging everybody at the expense of everything. And that's why by the end of the sketch, everything has fallen apart.
Right.
But
and the sketch can't really withstand, you know, that duration of time.
Yeah, and that's why some sketches feel they're going too long because they're playing with that for too long. But we have to believe that there is a day-to-day relationship, and Mila's character is too smart, even though she doesn't really have anything in her life, too smart to be around somebody who would be that self-sabotaging.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel like there's sometimes, you know, and you'll see a movie where it feels like the characters are sort of designed from the outside in, like they don't organically feel like they belong in the same movie, but it feels like they've sort of tried to dial up the interest or the differences so that it sort of opens up more comedy. And it, to me, it always does the opposite. You know, it's if I see a female character who has a best friend and that best friend seems like just this crazy sketch character who's, you know, a sidekick, very typey person, I never really believe that's a real friendship. So, you know, I just always see that person. I'm like, oh, they thought it would be funny to cast like a zany person with a fake movie job who brings home a guy every night. And that's going to be a joke that we're just going to have to keep watching and thinking that it's relevant to anything emotional, which it isn't. That always bothers me, you know, that kind of thing.
We're talking about Underpinning with my guest, Susanna Fogel, whose new film is writer-director, is The Spy Who Dumped Me. What we're really talking about here is creating a point of entry in a genre that's essentially sort of depersonalized and is about keeping us sort of excluded from it, except when the action happens, because they're so much about having iconic figures rather than people in them. Mm-hmm. We're just waiting to watch these people triumph. And so much of the fun in both these movies is at some point these characters have to figure out how to get out of their own way.
Yeah.
And the stakes are different here, but it happens in both of these films, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that is like the struggle of getting older is really figuring out why you're not where you wanted to be, and whether that's sort of that you haven't pursued the right dream, or, you know, that the world just isn't this idealized thing you thought it was when you were 21 or whatever. It's like kind of like engaging with reality versus continuing to pursue your dreams against the odds. These are the two messages that we get. We get a really conflicting set of messages, I think. We have the like dream big, you can do anything, and also you can't do anything. The world is, the competition is too great, and you don't want to end up like all those losers. You know, so I don't know. It's like, it's hard to tell how much confidence to have and how much realism and flexibility to have when you set your goals for yourself. So you often end up just paralyzed by choice anxiety about what you're supposed to be doing with all of your time.
Well, as you're talking, I was thinking about one of the things I'd like so much about this movie is there's a dynamic of these characters in these movies tending to not speak very much and to be very precise when they do speak. Mm-hmm. So having the movie built around people who don't have that precision.
I am like far too chatty of a person. And David and I are like way too neurotic and Jewish to do a movie where people are mostly seen and not heard. They're always heard. There's not a lot of mystery or subtlety in the way we communicate. We pretty much just say what we think the truth is.
But that's where a lot of the comedy comes from, the fact that these are two incredibly plain-spoken people who are in a world where every single moment something is revealed to them that they don't know.
Right. Like
every single moment in the movie, something new happens. Mm-hmm. And trying to roll with that while there's this implicit sort of understanding that we still don't know who we are. Right. In a world where everybody else knows exactly who they are and what they do at all given times.
Right. They're in a dialed up, highly specialized world where, not only is it the people in their home city knowing what they want to do, it's like incredibly skilled professionals working at the absolute top of their game. So, I think it's just about them kind of. I think it's about self-acceptance, too.
Well, that's funny what the movie is about. I mean, the moments of triumph are about self-acceptance.
Yeah, and celebrating parts of yourself, even as you're pushing yourself, like stopping to acknowledge the small victories is, I think, it's an important thing to let yourself do. I mean, we're so driven and ambitious and single-minded oftentimes, and sometimes if you don't acknowledge like the micro victories, you never get to acknowledge any victories at all, because all you get is a little validation here and there. You know, you don't always get, you know, the highest level of success, especially not overnight. And without giving yourself like a little pat on the back, sometimes you can't possibly keep going, especially as a creative person. Like the well, like, is often empty. You know, you'll finish a movie or you'll have a bad creative experience and you just feel like you can't find the motivation to connect with anything creative, like the well is just dried up. So in those moments, I mean, you have to kind of be kind to yourself, I think, a little bit. It's a hard lesson, but it's something I believe in more and more.
Well, it's what you're talking about is something that really happens in the movie too, that when there is a triumph at the end, they aren't monumentally better people. They're still, in effect, kind of the same people like with the beginning of the movie, with a better understanding of themselves. There is the dawning of self-awareness.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, without the sort of like framework of this sort of the flashiness of the sort of the genre stuff and the sort of the context in which they're fish out of water, without that, I think it could just be a movie about two friends going on an incredibly subtle journey where they don't change that much. I mean, it could be like the smallest, least producible indie movie without the other trappings.
The movie you're describing, I feel like I've seen too many times at Sundance.
Yeah, I mean, it's like when I started out making films, I assumed that I would make movies, if not like that, definitely not like this one. I mean, it wasn't a dream of mine to make huge tentpole style movies.
It wasn't, because I would have thought just what you bring to bear, the kind of wherewithal you bring to this is, first and foremost, if you look at Nuclear Family or Life Partners, these are kind of small emotional stories that are told. Mm-hmm. Again, with people trying to talk.
Yeah, right. Trying to communicate and often failing, yeah.
Because they're too busy explaining to take a minute to think about who and what they are and what's going on.
Right.
But putting that in the context of a world where professionalism is the most valued thing, mm-hmm. and being in the right place at the right time and knowing when not to say something, all these things that are what movies tell us we're supposed to be able to do. That's basically the kind of the epitome of cool. I would have thought that you would have wanted to bring the gifts that you have to a genre that doesn't take time to be reflective in that way.
I mean, it has become a passion for me. It just wasn't where I started, I guess.
But where did this come from, this shift? Because
when I first kind of moved out to LA to pursue this career with some shorts under my belt that were very talky, very little going on with the camera, lots going on in the words. It sort of was a slightly different time in the industry. Like there were still a lot of kind of Bridget Jones style movies getting made. So I felt like, okay, there's a big movie that is character driven and female driven. I didn't think outside of those gender boxes or those genre boxes. I just said, okay, I'm going to be able to work my way up to making a big Hollywood movie that is the kind that women make, like that. And I didn't only want to do female-driven things, but I didn't look at those other genres that were lacking in character and necessarily see my place in them. I loved seeing them as a viewer, but I didn't think about marrying that with my more character-driven sensibilities until I think I tried to tell very small indie stories so many times and kind of came up against the wall of just like of how hard it is to get those movies made if they ever do get made. And it weirdly felt like a door was closed that then opened this very exciting door that like has now become something that I love and consider my main passion, which is like taking these means of storytelling on this huge scale and seeing if I can infuse them with a bit more humanity and humor and a different lens.
Because it sounds like what you're saying too is that you realize that you're limiting yourself because there's also a kind of gender expectation to the kind of movie a woman should write and direct.
I mean, I think about this a lot. You know, obviously it's like very in the conversation now in general and in the conversation around like putting this movie out into the world. But for me, it's like an unconscious assumption that even I make sometimes, which is to say, well, I think what I mean is it's important to me to move the needle for like women or just move the needle for people like me in storytelling. And the question is what's the better way to contribute to progress? Is it to just create more great female characters? Is it like the meta progress of me directing a male-driven movie and with nothing gendered about it to just sort of show that we're humans, we direct things, and men have gotten to direct movies about everybody and anybody. And so do we really want to subdivide ourselves so much that we're only allowed to tell stories about people exactly like us? That can be really limiting too, especially since some of my favorite movies are, you know, I mean, a movie like Wonder Boys or Election, I mean, those are female, you know, one is about a girl and guy, and Tracy Flick is an iconic character that a man directed and two men wrote. So,
and came from a novel by a man.
It came from a novel by a man. So is that inauthentic? And are we like, are we going to discount the complete resonance of that movie because Tracy Flick was not conceived by a woman? Like I just don't think that that's the way to, you know, to look at art and storytelling, you know?
It sounds like an exciting moment when you had this kind of realization, just that rather than doing the thing I expect to do and that others expect of me.
Yeah.
And also the kind of thing you could probably have some success with. You could write that script a lot of times and sell it and nobody will make it because it's been made before. But
yeah.
if you do it artfully enough, people will still see that there's some talent in the writing. But you're not just writing to have people put these things on challenge. You're writing these movies to get them made.
Yeah, it's a different thing. I think moving into directing too was, it's just, it was an instrumental part. I mean, I know that as a director, if this movie had been written by someone else and I had just been the director of Life Partners, I doubt I would have been in contention for this just based on the fact that it was a huge leap. And the only way I could like inoculate myself against people saying I didn't understand the tone was to have written it myself and say like, you're never going to tell me that I don't understand the tone. I am the tone, you know?
I'm sorry, we've run out of time. We clearly have a lot more to talk about, so make another movie so you can come back.
Okay, definitely.
My guest who's made a terrific new movie, and it's, as you heard her talking about, there's a lot to see in this movie, which is the fun of it. It explodes so many expectations about genre in and of itself, and that's the thrill of this movie. The Spy Who Dumped Me, my guest is its co-writer and director, Susanna Pogel. Again, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Elvis.
My pleasure. Recording engineer here at NPR West is Leo DeLaggio. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited, and she's got a lot of work to do on this one by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I'm going to stop talking. Catch up on past episodes with the treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.